is a show where four Catholic men opine on current affairs of the world, on matters of faith, culture, and politics. It's unfiltered, it's daring, and it's certainly unapologetic.
The Rundown is a weekly news show. But it's more than that. It's a family of like-minded Catholics who are preparing for the coming chastisement.
You cover church news, politics, and current events around the world, linking them in a way no one else does, giving you the perspective no one else can.
The Rundown is not meant for children because it informs and prepares parents, young adults, seminarians, even priests watch The Rundown to know about the most pressing and evolving threats to the Catholic faith today.
Brought to you by Restoring the Faith Media. RestoringTheFaith.com.
Let me address recent unfounded attacks on the professionalism of the FBI and Justice Department agents and prosecutors. I will not stand by silently when their integrity is unfairly attacked. The men and women of the FBI and the Justice Department are dedicated, patriotic public servants.
Richard Stubbo.
Target 8 taking you inside the takedown of the FBI agent who led one of the nation's biggest domestic terror investigations. Tonight, for the first time, police body cam video of the first blow to the federal team prosecuting one of Michigan's highest profile cases ever, the alleged plot to kidnap Governor Gretchen Whitmer. Former FBI agent Richard Trask is scheduled to enter a plea tomorrow on charges he beat and choked his wife. But Target 8 investigator Susan Samples discovered the former agent didn't just betray his badge off duty, he also spewed vitriol online, revealing his personal politics amid perhaps the most politicized federal investigation in Michigan's history.
The men and women of the FBI and the Justice Department are dedicated, patriotic public servants.
Shots fired at me. Over here, guys!
Watch out, he's shooting.
Take cover on the building! Are you over there by the orbit room?
Affirmative. Shots fired.
New dash cam and body cam video revealing the intense moments an FBI agent opened fire on Grand Rapids police and the bizarre interview that took place after it was all over.
The men and women of the FBI and the Justice Department are dedicated, patriotic public servants.
One of its agents, after his gun went off while he was dancing and doing a little gymnastic movement, the incident was caught on video and left one person wounded in the leg. Jeff Begays is outside the Bureau's headquarters in Washington. Jeff, good morning.
Good morning. This definitely was not that agent's finest hour. Now his career is on the line. The shooting happened in a Denver nightclub early Saturday morning. The agent was off duty when his gun accidentally fired.
He was dancing, and then right as he did that backflip, his gun fell out and it hit the ground. It shot off.
Kara Chancellor was in Denver's Mile High Spirits Distillery and Tasting Bar when the off-duty FBI agent dropped his gun and accidentally fired it when he tried to grab it.
Can you tell us anything more? Was he watching the news? Was he scrolling Twitter? Did someone in his staff flag it for him?
I can tell you this. He was not aware of the raid?
We are serious podcasters, news professionals. This is your Disinfo Hour. The Fab Four are here. Mar-a-Lago, top news tonight. Ryan, Mar-a-Lago was raided by your Federal Bureau of Investigation. Now we know that it's in good hands, right? We know that.
Oh, absolutely. Were any of them dancing? That's kind of what I want to know. As they're going through, they're dancing through Melania Trump's wardrobe or something. I don't know. It's a weird thing. And the legal analysts, I mean, you see the partisan, you know, sides of people who can't stand the former president. We're not big fans of him, but at the same time, we tend to be a little more dispassionate about these things. And as I'm looking into it, it does look odd on a number of levels that they're going to go through this. There's so many ways in which this could be done very carefully. I've watched a couple of former FBI agents who've been on the news that have said that they don't really understand why they had to issue a warrant to go get these things. Whatever they are, because if it was that dangerous, if it was that much of a national security risk, why has this taken so long? You know, that it would have been like, you know, step one as soon as they're aware of it. But obviously, it's not that great of a risk. Why is it they're going into it? And it leads to what a lot of people have said, that it looks more like a political stunt 60 days out from midterms.
Yeah. The Federal Bureau of Investigation, we're really proud of our officers. Here's Ted Cruz questioning one of them.
Recently, there was the case against individuals charged with kidnapping and murdering Governor Gretchen Whitmer in Michigan. That case ended up an absolute debacle where the four people who went to trial, two of them were acquitted, two received mistrials. None of them were convicted on even a single charge, and the basis of the defense was entrapment, that the FBI, that paid enforcements for the FBI, had suggested and had incited the conduct. Let me ask you, how many FBI agents were disciplined or reprimanded after that disastrous case and the misconduct that led to every defendant being acquitted or having a mistrial on every charge?
Senator, I can't comment on a personnel matter. I can tell you that case, as I understand it, is now pending a retrial, as I understand it.
Well, the special agent in charge of that case has now been sent to D.C., to the Washington, D.C. office, and now leads the investigation regarding January 6th. Is that correct?
That doesn't sound right to me.
That does not sound right. The name of the individual is Stephen D'Antuono. He was run out of the FBI Detroit field office. And by the way, I will point out that the lead investigator, Special Agent Track, are you aware that he was apparently fired for allegedly beating his wife after coming home from a swingers party, and he'd made multiple derogatory political posts about President Trump showing political bias? Are you aware of that?
I am aware of, I think, the incident you're describing and action that was taken about it. To clarify on the first part of your question, Mr. D'Antuono was the special agent in charge of the office, the Detroit field office, and is now the assistant director in charge of the Washington field office. I thought you were asking about the agent who was responsible for the...
So the guy in charge got promoted and is now in charge of the January 6th investigation.
The guy in charge of the whole Detroit field office is now in charge of the whole Washington field office.
That is astonishing.
I think that's called the Peter Principle. Does that sound right? Have you guys heard of this, the Peter Principle? I was just made aware of the Peter Principle at a business networking thing I was doing. Someone was describing it to me, and essentially, like, the least competent person, like the worst people, always get promoted because like no one wants to deal with them.
That's what they call it. I dealt with that my whole life.
We call it in the industry I used to work in, failing up. Lots of people are good at failing up. Like, you can't do your job, and so you get promoted out of your job.
That explains the episcopate then.
Exactly. I stole the words right out of my mouth.
Exactly. So let's talk about this whole Trump thing, because you're right, Ryan. You set it up brilliantly. We're not Trump aficionados per se, but it is interesting. You know, I know a certain fake news organization where when you point out that they're doing something, then they write articles accusing you of doing exactly that thing that they themselves have done. And it's so funny because now we have Hillary Clinton actually did mishandle classified information. She had hundreds of classified emails on her email server in her basement. We know that those emails were compromised by Russia, China, and our other adversaries. We know that the classification levels for at least 100 of those emails were top secret special access protocol. Now, look, as someone who has a top secret security clearance, I don't have SAP. I don't have SCI, special compartmentalized information access. You have to have a need to know these things. And yet Hillary was putting them on her freaking cell phone and keeping them in her basement. The things that they came in into Trump's house for, James, I don't know if you can hear me. Can you thumbs up if you can? Yeah. They came into Trump's house. Washington Post reporting that supposedly he has some nuclear secrets that they were going after. That's not in the search warrant that was released today at 3 o'clock Eastern. They took 20 boxes of stuff out of his house, including things like golf balls, signed napkins. I mean, this is the pressing national security crisis to take the golf balls from Mar-a-Lago. What are we going to do, James?
Yeah, this has been one of the strangest weeks in politics. And of course, for the nation at large, dealing with intelligence agencies that don't know exactly what they're doing, and whether or not they know that the whole world is seeing this as a political witch hunt is yet to be known, because they're all walking around practically exposing their bias, their hatred, whatever you want to call it, for the former president. Now, you just said what I was going to say is, you know, we don't particularly have this relationship with Trump as the other conservatives do out there, but at least we like to understand that there's a rule of law and that everyone is being held to those same rules. Now, what's understood now is disproportionately the conservatives slash Republicans are always, you know, the ones having to deal with all of this kind of stuff. We've seen Trump dealing with it. We've seen, you know, Republican candidates for office for the Senate and for Congress dealing with this kind of disproportionate police involvement in their races. You know, and you know, we have a race coming up November 2nd, you know, midterm elections. And so all this kind of plays into that. You know, what's exactly happening here? I don't know, but these FBI agents are going out there parading in Melania's closet. And you have people like Lindsey Graham. I have to dunk on Lindsey Graham. He's out there posturing for goodness knows what. Yet he didn't lift a finger to do anything when Liz Cheney was running her mouth about January 6th. Didn't do anything post-2020 elections when people were crying foul. You know, and all of a sudden now he's got that bravado again, you know, because we're nearing the midterm elections. And so he has to show himself as being the brave Republican. But we all know what's happening. He's so happy to go back to South Carolina this weekend because he knows the FBI have a special delivery waiting for him. And he's going to open it up and he's going to unbox a whole lot of Melania's unmentionables. And he's going to be so happy.
I have to caution you on two things. Number one, if you dunk on Lindsey Graham, he might enjoy it. And number two, the presidential closet that they need to be looking at is Michelle Obama. I just want to know how many men's clothes and jock straps they're going to find. Brother Martin.
You said it, not me.
I'm sorry for that transition to you, Brother Martin. It's very imprudent of me, but hey, we're having fun tonight. It is the Rundown Friday night. You got to subscribe to the YouTube channel, by the way. If you haven't subscribed, then anathema to you. Brother Martin. There's no rule of law anymore. There's no such thing as law. I don't even know that the powers that are governing our lives right now are legitimate. What is a poor Catholic to do living in an illegitimate society? Brother Martin.
Jesus, there.
There you go.
Oh, sorry.
You're the first. You're never the one. You're never the offender. And tonight you're the first offender.
I didn't mute myself.
It's my fault. I muted him because the static on his end.
What a man.
Is it static?
Sorry.
Okay. Well, I'll try to fix whatever static. Regarding our ordinary lives, well, we just live our ordinary lives, acknowledging whatever authority is there. However, more and more, I guess within my own prayer and conscience, I think there really is a need for all of us to be able to prepare for whenever the government, in the sense, attacks us. We just saw 87,000, the IRS wanting to hire 87,000 new agents that are all willing to exercise lethal force. This is absolutely incredulous. I think more and more we've seen President Biden not using so much the military to attack the American people, but using other agencies within the government's power to exercise its force. the fact that 87,000 agents have been hired by the IRS that are willing to use lethal force, or they're trying to hire these, tells us, the people, that one by one they're going to be coming after us with lethal force. So really,
it's so funny. They took that job posting offline too, Brother Martin. Like, as soon as it made the rounds on social media that you're hiring people who know a little bit of about accounting, can lift a box, you know, have to have a professional. Oh, and by the way, deadly force, use of deadly force.
Listen, I'm trying to
trash collector.
I'm trying to talk around the bush, but I'll say bluntly, everybody who's listening should know how to shoot a gun.
Yeah.
Pure and simple. We're coming to those times.
Yeah. It's getting bad. It is getting bad. Gentlemen, anyone else want to jump in on this Trump thing? I mean, look, there's a lot more to say. The hypocrisy of it is astonishing. Here's what I'll say about it, and I'll toss back to you, Ryan. Mm-hmm. They do these things so brazenly and in open, in full view, to mock our own sensibilities. It is such a brazen injustice what's happening. And it is a mockery, and it is an irony that they are now accusing Donald J. Trump of precisely the crime that we know that Hillary Clinton committed, that even Comey said that she committed. But Comey said no reasonable prosecutor would bring charges against Hillary Rodham Clinton for keeping special access protocol, top secret material in her basement. That is a leak that would have sent my you-know-what to Leavenworth if I had done that when I was on active duty. And yet Hillary gets away with it. Trump takes some boxes of memorabilia, signed napkins and such. And this is a national security crisis, Ryan. They're mocking us.
Of course they are. That's part of what their entire montage has been, their mojo, their modus operandi from who knows when. Always accuse the enemy of what you yourself are doing. And you laid that out a little bit earlier. So, I mean, Hillary Clinton, I don't know if anyone remembers this one. During the early years of Baby Bush, former Clinton National Security Advisor Sandy Berger, who remembers him, he was caught stuffing classified info from the National Archive into his pants. He walked out of the building, and then they start scrambling people to go after him, and they find him. He's burned those documents. No charges.
Nothing happened
to him. And so this is clearly political, and Trump himself, in my opinion, is not necessarily the target. We are through him, whether you like him or not, just what he represents to the left.
Great point.
With his conservatism, family values, whatever. So if you're like us, where we're somewhat skeptical of Trump and be like, not as bad as what we got now, or right, you're totally, you know, rah-rah, MAGA hat, everything, you love Trump, then in fine, none of my business. But it's like, it doesn't really matter. As far as the left is concerned, we're all the same, because we're not woke leftists turning our kids into, whatever opposite, whatever alphabet letter of the month it is.
Is it turning our kids into what the second half of the rundown always talks about invariably, which we will do tonight.
If you want, there's some follow-up on that FBI agent. I've got a video. Part of it was in the intro. And I've got a Twitter thread on it, because I think it actually goes further into.
Pull it up, because the Bureau, the Federal, you know, it's funny too. While you're pulling it up, there are certain news organizations out there that pretend as though they distrust the FBI, unless the feds are involved in accusing a priest they don't like, in which case the feds don't get it wrong. But then again, if the feds go after dear leader Trump, then the feds are. So you gotta be consistent, people. You right? Gotta either say that the feds are right or they're wrong, but you can't have it both ways.
Especially when your feds are like this guy.
Shots fired at me.
Over here, guys!
Watch out, he's shooting.
Take cover on the building! Are you over there by the orbit room?
Affirmative. Shots fired.
New dash cam and body cam video revealing the intense moments an FBI agent opened fire on Grand Rapids police and the bizarre interview that took place after it was all over. We got the video through the Freedom of Information Act, and Susan Samples is here to break down what the video shows us. Susan?
Brian, police turned over nearly two dozen video clips to us from the dash cams and body cams of several Grand Rapids police officers. We get to see the first interview also with Las Vegas FBI Special Agent Ruben Hernandez moments after he allegedly fired his gun at police. But first, we want to show you what led up to his arrest. This all happened just after 1 a.m. at the Planet Fitness gym near Centerpoint Mall. Within minutes of getting the call of a man with a gun, a small army of officers shows up. In this clip, you can see a team of officers in tactical gear, helmets and shields, slowly approach Ruben, who is already on the ground, his gun already in the parking lot. In the interview, you can hear Hernandez is clearly confused.
Anybody that's wearing this uniform, I will not hurt you, ma'am.
Okay.
Yo no hago eso.
Por favor. Hey, here's the thing, okay? You have a holster on you. There's a gun in the parking lot. Stop talking. There's a gun in the parking lot from the direction that you came. You took a shot at one of our officers. You're not going anywhere. You're going to stay in the car until someone can come and talk to you. Do you understand that?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Ma'am, can you take it off from me?
No.
I will not. Oh.
Then
I don't know about you, but it seems kind of like he's up on something.
But by the way, the standards of the FBI on paper, so I've heard, so I've been told by supervisory special agents that I know, they're not supposed to drink alcohol ever because they're never off duty. This guy's high as a kite.
And then there's our friend from Michigan.
Richard Stubbo.
Target 8 taking you inside the takedown of the FBI agent who led one of the nation's biggest domestic terror investigations. Tonight, for the first time, police body cam video of the first blow to the federal team prosecuting one of Michigan's highest profile cases ever, the alleged plot to kidnap Governor Gretchen Whitmer. Former FBI agent Richard Trask is scheduled to enter a plea tomorrow on charges he beat and choked his wife. But Target 8 investigator Susan Samples discovered the former agent didn't just betray his badge off duty. He also spewed vitriol online, revealing his personal politics amid perhaps the most politicized federal investigation in Michigan's history.
Aggravated domestic?
Yeah, with strangulation.
We don't know if he's armed.
These are the calls that can careen into chaos, turn deadly in an instant.
Sheriff's office.
On this night, the risk ratcheted so much higher.
Sheriff's office, anybody in?
This suspect doesn't just know police tactics, he lives them.
And counterterrorism. Yeah, he'd be hiding anywhere.
We're getting the kids out of the house right now.
So we don't know if he's armed. He's been drinking.
Is he intoxicated?
Trask, T-R-A-S-K, and first name of Richard.
Richard Trask, not just any federal agent, but a lead investigator in the middle of one of the Fed's most critical cases.
Not turning the volume off in this case. Keep it on the whole time.
You said at one point, took your head and hit it against the nightstand?
Yeah.
How many times did you hit that?
Multiple times, said Trask's wife.
He's hitting your head. You said he strangled you, choked you out.
She's got a pretty good laceration on the side of her head. She's got strangulation marks around her neck.
Richard Trask's wife had called 911 around 2 a.m. July 18th, told Kalamazoo County deputies the couple had returned home from a Kalamazoo area hotel, a swingers party she hadn't wanted to attend.
Where was this argument? Was this in your bedroom?
Trask's wife said they'd been arguing about the party when he smashed her head against the nightstand and grabbed her by the neck. She managed to break free, and the FBI special agent took off in her car.
Please record your message. When you've finished recording, you may hang up or press 1 for more options.
Hey, Richard. It's Deputy Kidd, Kalamazoo County Sheriff's Department. Just trying to talk to you. Looks like we have an incident at your house tonight. I'm trying to get your side of the story.
2 hours later in a shopping center parking lot.
Yeah, Richard, step up.
What?
Step up.
All right.
What is going on? What is going on?
Cuffed on a felony charge of assault with intent to do great bodily harm.
Any weapons on you?
No.
Okay, where are your guns at?
At the house.
At the house, you have none with you, though?
No.
You want to take them? You got a statement?
All right, Richard.
I'm going to read you your Miranda warnings.
There would be no statement from the special agent whose signature 9 months earlier sealed the government's criminal complaint charging six men with conspiring to kidnap Michigan's governor.
Do you understand each of the rights I've explained to you?
Yep. Richard Trask is an honorable man who has served this community for many, many years. He has spent his entire career protecting and serving this nation.
Turns out Trask, clean-shaven here for court, had also spent a lot of time on social media.
Agent Trask, I need to talk to you about your Facebook posts.
Target 8 uncovered Trask's Facebook account, where he posted memes mocking COVID deniers.
I read your anti-Trump Facebook posts.
In one of Trask's so-called toilet thoughts of the day, he wrote, quote, if you still support our piece of blank president, you can blank off. As someone whose wife works in the hospital, I hope you burn in hell along with your blank blank reality TV star. His ego is going to kill a lot of people, and anyone who supports him is a dumb blank. Trask wrote, this is what you get when you elect an egotistical, narcissistic maniac to the top office. He needs people to be nice to him or he won't help. That post, dated March 28, 2020, which was early on in the FBI's investigation into the alleged conspiracy among militia members to kidnap Michigan's Democratic governor.
Why you would post things like that while you're investigating the kidnapping plot case?
No comment, which clearly won't be the case for attorneys defending the alleged kidnap plotters, who are questioning the credibility of Trask and the two other main agents on the case, trying to mount an entrapment defense, arguing.
Essentially, without the government's involvement in some way or the government's sponsorship in some way, the crime would not have been committed.
Former U.S. Attorney Michael Zwieback told Target 8 Trask's Facebook posts call into question his judgment. But experts say the posts do not violate the law banning partisan political activity.
I think that's going on far enough, but you get the picture there. And it, especially it ties in with the COVID stuff, too. I mean, these are the people at the top.
A guy like Trask has the ability to deprive you of your life and your liberty, your rights, your property, your freedom. A guy like Trask can put you in jail. A guy like Trask, who goes to swinger parties, beats his wife, drives drunk, is in charge, and posts about how bad Trump is in charge of entrapping you, planting bombs with you, giving you bombs, and then arresting you for having those bombs. I mean, like this is not the American Republic that the rah-rah founding fathers thought of. And it's certainly not a crypto-Catholic nation like our very misguided skateboarding loser friend of ours says. And here's where this is going. Where is this going? Great Britain is always a little bit ahead of us. You guys in the UK, you're always fashion forward. This is where it's going.
Nope. The Hampshire police would realise how ridiculous this is.
It is. What did it need to come to?
Tell us why you escalated it to this level. Because I don't understand. I posted something that he posted. You come to arrest me, you don't arrest him. Why has it come to this? Why am I in cuffs? Because of something he shared, then I shared.
Because someone has been caused, obviously, anxiety based upon your social media post.
You're now going to go to jail, James, over a social media post. That's the next thing that's coming. That's the new hotness. A guy who sits on the toilet after a swingers party, after bloodying his wife's head and choking her out because she didn't want to participate in a swingers party. That guy who posts vitriol online is going to be the one arresting you for what you're doing on the rundown.
You can imagine this. I mean, this is quite disconcerting, at least it should be, to those who are saying Republicans are misogynists or conservatives are misogynists, what have you. All the various names that conservatives are called. And here's a federal agent with, arrest powers, basically saying, you know what, wife, if you don't like the party that I want you to go to, I'm going to bash your head against a wall and you're going to bleed and you're going to like it. And this is the people, these are the kind of people that we are giving federal powers to. It's absolutely asinine. But if going back 10 years, you know, that I mean, I remember being in D.C. and seeing starting to see a bunch of these guys entering into office and kind of realizing, you know what, the old school agents are on their way out. Matter of fact, you know, there's a new breed of FBI agents coming in, and they're the ones who are most likely to do anything and say anything to keep their power. And this is what has happened here is, you know, Ray, FBI Director Ray, has given this guy a promotion for what reason, I don't know, except upholding what he believes in his views are what FBI agents should be doing. In his view, he got a promotion and now he's in Washington, D.C.
Yep. And, you know, and the man who's in charge of all of these people, the chief law enforcement officer in the United States of America, chief executive, commander in chief. You can tell that he's keeping a tight grip on these United States, Brother Mark. Gotta get that jacket off, brother. Need some help with that blazer.
It's been a while since I've worn a blazer, but it's always funny watching those military guards just looking there just stiff as your commander in chief is struggling, even holding his glasses on his face before they fall off.
I'm so glad that we have someone who's not senile in charge of the United States of America.
Well, that's it.
Also, I'm so glad that he has decided to actually finish the wall. At least, you know what? That's one policy that I agree with fake Catholic usurper Chief Joe Biden on.
Why is the Biden administration building a border wall in Arizona?
So, we are not finishing the wall. We are cleaning up the mess the prior administration left behind in their failed attempt to build a wall. And I just want to be very, very clear here. On day one, we returned the money, the $8 billion the prior administration took from our military. We gave that back to the military for military families, for schools, for bases. That's what that money was being used. That's what it was taken away from. And so, again, what we're doing is cleaning up the mess that the prior administration has done.
But President Biden, when he was a candidate, said, there will not be another foot of wall constructed in my administration. Yeah. So what changed?
We are not finishing the wall.
If walls work in that part of Arizona, is this the administration trying to get migrants to cross somewhere else, like in Texas? What is the plan?
We are not finishing a wall. We are cleaning up the mess that the prior administration made. We are trying to save lives. This is what the prior administration left behind that we are now cleaning up.
By finishing the wall, is this?
We are not finishing the wall.
By filling in, finishing?
We are not finishing the wall.
By filling in, is this racist? Because in 2019, when the former guy was proposing a wall, you said that it was his racist wall. So how is this any different? I'm just having a hard time understanding how this is any different.
I'm not even sure how you get to your first question, to this question that you just asked me. I will say this. A border wall, I'm answering your question. A border wall is ineffective use of taxpayer dollars. So it's ineffective of taxpayer dollars. Dollars that actually went to the military that the last administration, the prior president, took from the military, which took away from schools, which took away from military bases. That's what that money that he pulled away from to build this wall that he wanted that is ineffective, by the way, which I just said. Just recently,
you know, I just have to say one thing. Affirmative action is my favorite thing in the world. Here's a cat. Everyone likes cats. Here's a cat. This video is entitled Bodyguard Cat. Oh, Johnny, don't fall. Don't touch that. Cats are so controlling. Look at that cat. Johnny's like, I'm going to come over here. I'm going to touch this thing. The cat's like, no, you're not.
Guardian angel cat.
Why do people like cats so much?
I don't ask me.
Because
yeah, well, Ryan's got a cat, yeah.
I got a couple, although they're outside only. Because generally speaking, they catch mice. When you feel like petting a cat, they'll come on over. When you don't, they're like, oh, screw you, I'm going to go over and do this. So it's not a terribly demanding animal and doesn't kill your sheep, kill other people's sheep, bark incessantly,
yeah.
Dig holes, dig up people's gardens.
But let me ask you, Ryan. A cat has nipples. Can you milk a cat?
I don't think I want to know the answer to the question.
Okay, so we talk about Trump, you know, and look, here's what we need to actually say about Trump as well. And I don't want to be the person to say it, but I'll just do it. His reelection campaign has been revived by this whole Mar-a-Lago thing. We all know that. I think there's a big possibility that this is more political theater. But speaking of political theater, we also need to examine the alternative to Trump that is being put forward to us. And in this case, it's Ron DeSantis, who he's committed a blasphemy. He has taken blessed St. George Floyd's name in vain, ladies and gentlemen. So I don't know if he's qualified for the White House.
They would shame people for even leaving their house in April, May 2020, and you can't do it. And, you know, some people wanted to bury loved ones. They wanted to do this. And the argument people were making is, well, wait a minute. I can look at the risk of COVID, and it's something that I'm willing to accept because these things mean more to me, to be able to bury a loved one or to be able to do things with my family. And the public health establishment, oh, no, you can't make that kind of cost-benefit analysis. Then, when the George Floyd riots were happening, they actually wrote a letter with thousands of these people signing it saying, we do not believe that rioting and protesting is bad for COVID, that you can do it, go ahead, because we think it's so important that you have to do it. And then they said, but this doesn't mean we support all protests. If you're protesting lockdown policies or other things, then you can't do that. And that's when I knew these people are a bunch of frauds. I mean, how ridiculous.
He took the left-wing saint. And by the way, Brother Martin, the Bishop of Dallas, Texas, canonized St. George Floyd. He had a St. George Floyd mass that I think he personally presided over. And he may not even be the only high-ranking prelate in the United States to have canonized St. George Floyd. I think it was done in Chicago, too, of course. Maybe not by Subic himself, but one of his lackeys. So I don't know, man. As I look at it, brother, I look at DeSantis and I'm like, I like you in Florida. I agree with you, Ryan. But also, look, if you're going to take George Floyd's the blessed, the great name in vain, I kind of like that too.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we want this guy to remain in his prime for sure. Absolutely. We want him to, because even though he's the governor of Florida, he's giving a lot of people hope that, I mean, we're not all crazies, that there is possibilities for governors. I mean, I think, especially in lockdowns and stuff, Governor DeSantis was taking the first step and being the courageous one to ignore a lot of the left wing propaganda. And then the governor of Texas, for instance, Abbott, was then kind of following in his footsteps. And so in one sense, it makes sense that there'd be a governor who risks everything, so to speak, to go against a liberal agenda so that other conservative governors can see that, well, there's no establishment consequences to it, and then can continue, and then each state can then give us our freedom, so to speak. But then We also have to weigh the possibility of, well, let's say this guy was actually the president of the United States and gives us all of these freedoms point blank, you know, across all 50 states all at one time. That's also another possibility. But I think the real thing for us, I mean, to discern if Governor DeSantis runs in the primary and Trump runs in the primary is, I mean, sure, Trump gave us a lot of freedoms that Obama didn't and would continue to give us a lot of freedoms that Biden hasn't. But Trump wasn't necessarily perfect. And so we have to kind of look at both candidates and see, well, is there one that gives us even more than what the other one doesn't? For instance, I mean, Trump, if he was asked, would you be against the Supreme Court overturning Obergefell, you know, gay marriage? Mm-hmm. I can see Trump saying, well, I believe love is love. And, you know, gay marriage doesn't really hurt anybody except, you know, all that kind of stuff. I can see Trump saying that because he holds a gay pride flag and, you know, accepts the LGBT vote. That's DeSantis, true. However, I can see taking a different stance, a different position.
Can I just ask you one question, brother? Like, do we all have to pronounce it DeSantis, or can we just say DeSantis? I just want to. I don't want to be accused of anything.
You're Texan. You're Texan. You can say DeSantis.
I want to say Ron DeSantis. That's what I want to say, Ryan. Ron DeSantis.
Ron DeSantis. I'm liking him more and more. I just my natural inclination toward anyone in government, no matter how good they sound, is I believe it when I see it. I don't buy into it. So it's not what they seem. And there's always something. No one's going to be absolutely perfect. So even if he is genuine, though, the situation in D.C., the civil service there, the whole apparatus is so completely corrupted. And so we're talking about the FBI just a little while ago. Obviously, the FBI is an organization, has a lot of people in it. Obviously, there are people there who are competent, who want to do their job. It's also loaded up with people like some of the individuals we've been shown with. And the same thing is true with every other branch of the federal government. You have, so much gridlock. What in 4 years, even to say he only gets 4 years, what can he realistically do to help? At the very best, you can say if he's truly honest and he truly is on the level, he'll try to limit the evil. Right.
Yeah.
That's, I think, the best that we can say for him. I wish that I could say, you know, hey, we're going to have a great crusader. You're going to have someone's going to restore public order. It's not going to happen. Even if he is authentic, the best that he can do is merely limit the evil. If he's not, it's not all, in fact, all a show. And there's, and I'm also firmly convinced, too, that when every president that gets, like the first or second day in the Oval Office, he gets in a room and he's shown a video of the Kennedy assassination from an angle that nobody has ever seen before. And then they turn and say, any questions?
I think that'd be a pretty effective in briefing of any new commander in chief, you know. And the question is, I mean, this is actually a pretty good question, though. Given the power, the technology that the Leviathan wields, does it really matter if it's Ron DeSantis or DeSantis? Or Trump, or anyone that we ostensibly like? I mean, look, these people now have the capabilities to target our own DNA, to send out weapons that are bioweapons targeting our own unique DNA, and they talk about it in the open.
So to be clear, I think one of the things we're talking about here is that there are now weapons under development and developed that are designed to target specific people. Right, that's what this is, where you can actually take someone's DNA, take, you know, their medical profile, and you can target a biological weapon that will kill that person or take them off the battlefield or make them inoperable. So you can't have a discussion about this without talking about privacy and commercial data and the protection of commercial data, because expectations of privacy have degraded over the last 20 years. Young folks actually have very little expectation of privacy. That's what the polling and the data show. And people will very rapidly spit into a cup and send it into 23andMe and get really interesting data about their background. And guess what? Their DNA is now owned by a private company and can be sold off with very little intellectual property protection or privacy protection.
Well, it's interesting, James. He's talking about 23andMe, the Mormons, spitting in a cup. You know, the example that he didn't use was forced testing, forced DNA scraping up your nose into your brain. PCR testing.
Yeah, he's actually right. And of course, he didn't use that as an example because that, in a sense, is still something that can trigger people. Although the reality is there are people out there who are so eager to do well by their body, you know, using the words of the so-called scientists, Fauci and the others, they're so eager to do well by their body that they will forego anything closely related to protection of privacy. You know, and he's right. These youth, these younger generation, they don't have any expectation whatsoever. And I'm saying any at all. They have zero expectation about privacy. I remember years ago arguing in front of some college students, telling them, you have a right to privacy and you have to, first and foremost, protect that right. And I was met with, well, if I haven't done anything wrong, then why should I be so concerned about having people access my private lives? You know? And so, of course, now you have a faction of those people today wondering why the government is tracking them, you know, when they don't want to take a vaccine shot. Well, this is the end result of decades long. And he's absolutely right. It took them mere decades to knock down that whole idea of privacy by targeting the young people with technology. When you give people technology, and you use technology as a bait, people will always say, you know what, this is easier for me. If I just do this, then I'll get this. And so that has become what has helped people to put down their walls, to lower their guards. Mm-hmm. And now they're accepting this new thing as something that is revolutionary and then also provides them a particular service of ease.
Yeah. I'm loving the comments. You guys in the live chat are this is the best audience on the internet. I don't care. I'll put you up against anybody. I don't care about anyone's numbers. I don't care about viewership. I don't care about engagement. You people who watch the rundown are absolutely the finest people in the world. And if you haven't subscribed to the YouTube channel, then I take back everything I just said and I subject you to another cat video where you go and subscribe. Where are my kitten? Where's my mean cat? There's a mean kitty in New York. Here he is. What an absolute brute. What a brute.
I would expect that in New York, actually.
I said we
it's
just
a
get
a New York cat. Is
we
it,
just get an NFL kicker and just to boot it off that tee.
Do cats take on the personality where they live? Because that is so New York. Just a brute. Just a rude. Okay, well, here's a kitty mafia. These must be Italian cats. I don't know.
Serious.
Oh, Italian cats would be singing songs together in the middle of the night, keeping everybody awake. I don't know.
That's it.
Yeah. Who knows? I don't know why people like cats. I hate
me
cats.
They're good at
actually, I take that back though. I met two cats today, and they're like hypoallergenic cats. I have an allergy to cats, which I think is a grace. Really, I think we should all
same,
be allergic
same here.
To cats.
I have an allergy to cats, so yeah.
I met two cats today, James the Lesser, that are like bred for people like us. I experienced no reaction to this cat, none.
Oh, wow!
And I had this cat like sitting right next to me for a couple hours. It's pretty good.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. Hey, did you guys know that Dr. E. Michael Jones just said the craziest thing on YouTube that I've ever heard him say?
They accused Ratzinger, after he resigned, the resignation they brought about, after he resigned, they accused him of Fahnenflucht, desertion under fire. I think they were right. I think they were right, because at the beginning of his papacy, he told Zaval, or Zaval quotes in his book, but he said, pray that when the wolves come, that I don't flee. Well, he fled in an unprecedented fashion. Okay. He fled, and that led directly to the papacy of Francis, which I think everyone concedes is a complete train wreck. You must be, how can I say this? Do you feel vindicated? I mean, C.D. Jackson once said that Stalin was the greatest salesman the United States of America had. So I'm going to say Pope Francis is the greatest salesman the SSPX ever had.
Well, I don't know if you're up to date on this one, Michael, but the SSPX is also guilty of Fahnenflucht.
Okay, I need to clarify. I don't think what he said is crazy insofar as I disagree with it. I just think I never thought in my lifetime, let's go all the way around on this one, Ryan James and brother, I never experienced this thought in my life that we would have Dr. E. Michael Jones say to Bishop Williamson or a prelate of the SSPX or utter the words, you must feel vindicated because of Traditionis Custodes. Ryan, is this the biggest, I don't know, Catholic news? It's not the biggest Catholic news, but it's pretty big, right?
Given that historically Jones has always been, he's never had a problem with the new mass. He's always been critical of traditionalists and the society in particular. So it's kind of a big turnaround for him. I don't know if he finally had a wake-up call or what the reason was for it.
He didn't say, and I want to be fair to Dr. Jones too. He's been on the show and maybe he'll come on the rundown soon. He didn't say you are vindicated. He said you must feel vindicated. So I don't know if it's strong evidence that he's turned a corner on the society or not. So anyway, sorry, Ryan, I cut you off.
Favorable interview. I mean, it's not a, I don't think it's bridged too far to say that he's at least thinking positively about in that direction anyway. But again, I don't know Jones at all. I don't know. I've just read some of his books and his articles and noted his comments on traditionalism in the past. The fact that he had Williamson on at all, I think, is a big sign. At least something's turning in his head.
It's something, right? Yeah. Fahnenflucht, James the Lesser. Thoughts on that? Last week, the rundown took a week off, so you could say that the rundown committed Fahnenflucht last week, I would say.
Well, certainly speaking, absolutely. That's a bit of a Fahnenflucht there. We're glad to be back. And my opinion on this is, it's a step in the right direction. It's pretty big for someone like E. Michael Jones. E. Michael Jones has been what we consider the back itch that you couldn't quite scratch, that it was always there. And he's now basically, it seems that he is heading in a new direction. And this direction basically is seeing what's happened since the papal abdication of Pope Benedict. Like he was mentioning, with Francis now as that new person we're dealing with, even voices like Father Zolsdorf back then, when 2007 Summarum Pontificum came out, he was saying, now there's no need for the society. And people kept telling him, well, first of all, the society are the ones who are actually pleading that the mass be for everybody, not just for them, the mass be for everybody. And then, and that they, priests have the right to say that mass, of course, creating, or being in that situation, one could have assumed, well, it's now over, but we always knew that there were modernists in Rome. We always knew that. Right. And so it took the right events to bring this all back up to the surface again. And that came when Benedict abdicated and the rise of Francis, who now realizes this has gotten too out of control. We need to actually disband traditionalism in general. So, of course, now people who aren't the likely friends of the society and of the Latin Mass in general are coming out and saying, wait a second. For the last 10 years, I've seen Summarum Pontificum in my diocese. I've been to one or two Latin masses, or my son enjoys going to Latin mass, and I've seen changes in him. And you're telling me all of a sudden now this is going to be thrown out? And this is where people are. People are doing just as Michael E. Jones is doing. And honestly, I did not know he was at least thinking in this way. But it's nice to see that he's at least coming around. I know he mentioned to the bishop that they had been, or rather on air, he mentioned that he and the bishop had been in prior communication at least one or two times before. So at least there's a dialogue going on between the two. And this is the kind of real ecumenism.
Well, I think it goes deeper than that, James. I've been told that Bishop Williamson, when he was in Winona and the rector of the SSPX seminary, that he would invite Dr. Jones to come and lecture to the seminarians. And he would even warn them. He's like, look, we have an enemy amongst us. He doesn't like us, but he's good on history. He's good on philosophy. He's good on certain things. And we're going to roll out the red carpet for him. Right. So I think that those two have been locked horns for decades. You're right. It is.
But that's the beauty. This is ecumenism at its best. You know, this is what we ought to be seeing out of this. Right. So,
yeah. Well, Brother Martin, tough question for you. Did Pope Benedict commit Fahnenflucht? Did he abandon us while we're all taking fire and now he's just chilling?
Oh, absolutely. That's not even a serious question. That's not even a serious question. But here's it. Okay. Let's talk about the Jews. Are you guys going to stop me?
I'm looking for a video. We seem to be having some technical difficulties. We've lost the connection with Brother Martin. I hope we get him back soon. I don't know, Ryan. I don't know what happened. Something about Red Sea and pedestrians. And wow, okay, that went south.
Yeah, he committed.
I was going to talk about just dinner, like center meals.
That's Fahnenflucht.
Fahnenflucht. Right. Oh man, Brother Martin, I'm putting you in timeout. Oh man.
Well, one thing about Benedict, though, I think it hasn't been said enough, because Benedict believes all the same things that Francis believes when you get down to it. He just has a different aesthetic. And he has a different approach to it all, but it all goes to the exact same place. And so the kind of romanticizing about Benedict, it's more of, oh, well, at least we had our traditional masses. We weren't under fire when Benedict was there. But now that he's gone and, you know, Francis, and obviously Francis is worse, but that doesn't mean the problems with Benedict just vanish or go away.
Well, that's a really good point. And you know what, if folks watch that entire hour between Dr. Jones and His Excellency Bishop Williamson, they will see that Jones very clearly sees that problem. He lays it out articulately, logically. He starts from the framing with Pope Benedict, and Bishop Williamson comes in and he sort of like tacks on this idea of, yes, he's a brilliant computer. I think he says he's a brilliant mind. It's just that the software controlling that computer is just malformed. He has a modernist software controlling a brilliant computer, and he just can't think. The man can't think. I thought that was pretty interesting insight from Bishop Williamson. Now, those two did disagree as to the extent. You know, Bishop Williamson wanted to say basically that although he has this malformed mind, and I'll kick it back to you, Ryan, that Pope Benedict, he is a modernist because of his malformation, but he has a good heart and he has good intentions, and he wanted to do right by the Latin Mass, and he wanted to undo some of the work that he had done when he was an abject, absolute anti-Thomist modernist at the council. And Jones wouldn't, you know, kind of was unrelenting on that point. It was like, nope, he's the same guy. You know, you're just not seeing it. It was fascinating. It was electrifying. It was must see TV. I don't know if you're watching the rundown. Go watch that instead. Why are you watching us?
Maybe I'm somewhere in between. I'm not sure. As I'd say, he is the same guy from the 60s, except that he does have a wider heart, I would say. I think you can see changes in Benedict's approach as Cardinal Ratzinger in certain respects. One is, early on, his book Feast of Faith, which Ignatius Press published, I think it's from 1982, unless I'm mistaken. There's the interview he gave after the 1984 Extraordinary Synod, where basically they all came together to pat themselves on the back about Vatican II. And Ratzinger said, well, not so fast. There's still a ton of problems that nobody seems to be noticing. Then, and again, Spirit of the Liturgy, and then other writings that he wrote in this regard, where, he clearly wasn't looking at the reform as being, and actually that would be one place where, at least given Francis's public statements, he wouldn't be in agreement on the historical point, obviously, because, he challenges the notion that the liturgy we got was actually the liturgy the council wanted, but he's still committed to it's essentially the same program that, and you could see it all through his works, even his more recent ones. When he became Pope, he wrote a little Life of Christ, kind of a theological scriptural exegetical work, which actually was an enjoyable work, but it still has a lot of problematic things, because again, you look at the whole theological milieu he comes out of. It comes out in that whole time with your De Lubac, with your von Balthasar, with Rahner, with all these people, and the fact that he broke from some of them later, because he wasn't as extreme. It's the trains still go into the same place. He's just on a different stop.
It's the same philosophy as conservatives are just liberals in slow motion. James, I know you want to get in on this. I know you want to kind of drive the point home that, here's the problem. A lot of the Bene V. Contists that I know, they want to hang their hat on. Okay, Francis can't be Pope because he's bad, and Benedict was so much better. But the truth is that upon closer review, I'm not so sure that that's true. What say you? You're muted, James. Yes, it wasn't me again. It was James the Lesser.
Okay. Settle down there, Mike. Now, you're absolutely right. And we have a lot of evidence on this. And if you're skeptical about the evidence, all you have to do is go back to Rorate Celi's blog entries from around that time, from 2013 back, maybe even to 2005, when he became Pope. You can kind of see how various times, much like we sit and we scratch our heads and wonder when we hear Barron talking to a Jew and maybe saying basically, well, Catholicism is a privileged way, and we pull our hair out and we wonder, well, how could he say that when he's in the presence of someone like that who needs to hear the truth? Right. So in that same vein, and even much more confusing, Benedict had people in his service who he was continually telling, hey, there's no need for you to convert. Your place is where you are right now. And a dear friend of his, too, who was working in the Vatican, I believe she was a Lutheran. And he told her she didn't have to convert. And these are the views that he was holding as sitting as Pope after he had written the Motu Proprio in the Latin Mass,
Yeah.
So, and there are various other things you can draw from that. The fact that as a Pope, he walked into the Muslims' mosques or whatever it is, and he took his shoes off because he was standing on sacred space. The Pope of the Catholic Church, the one true faith, walked into a mosque and took his shoes off because he was told he was standing on sacred space. Can you envision that in your mind, people? So, of course, in a sense, Ryan is actually right. Francis and Benedict are pretty much the same people. My argument against Benedict has always been, well, he's kind of a genteel, slow, results kind of guy. He's the reason why the other faction of Vatican II didn't run the gamut when they had the chance. He's the one who slowed them down, but still knowing that in the end, they were all going to be arriving at the same place. So you have Benedict now possibly in the position of doing certain things, and people right around him realizing, hey, Benedict, you're just moving way too slow. We need somebody who can ramp this up. And, we need Francis. And then in comes Francis, which is why he said continually, even till today, Francis and I, and I'm speaking, loosely here, but he said something to the effect of Francis and I are of the same mind. We're of the same thought. He's doing God's will or whatever it is he said. He hasn't come out and said anything that's negative or disparaging toward Francis. Not that he would, but there's a way to say something without saying it in a very dry cutout way. I mean, he's German, so he knows how to do that. But he hasn't done that in this instance.
Let's follow that logic. Hold that thought. Pope Emeritus, whatever that is,
right,
Ratzinger, saying that he's of the same mind as Pope Bergoglio. Who else is of the same mind of Pope Bergoglio?
And I would like to ask you a very clear pointed question. After this year, do you believe that sodomy should be considered a grave sin?
I do not know what the senator would bring. We now listen to the people of God, what they express. I start getting in reports, the Director General of the Senate. And so reading all of that, in September we make a first draft for the continental meetings which will take place. I think that, first of all, I would never consider sexuality separated from love.
The Bible has taught, for 2,000 years, that sodomy is a sin, an abomination to Christ.
But the Bible also said we should stone the woman who is an actress. The Bible has said that the sun turns around the earth. So the Bible is after an interpretation to the earth.
So the fundamental scriptural teaching on sin.
This is not a theological.
No. I know that I am in full agreement with Pope Francis.
Thank you.
Cardinal Jean-Claude Hollerich is the president of the Commission of the Bishops' Conference of the European Union and has held that post since March of 2018. He attacks Holy Scripture, Holy Writ, in order to justify the grave sin of sodomy, which calls out for the justice of Almighty God. He does so supposedly in the same mind. I am of the same mind as Pope Francis. James Lesser just reported that Pope Benedict claims that he's of the same mind as Pope Francis. Ladies and gentlemen, the Lavender Mafia have been in charge for much longer than anyone is really prepared to admit. Brother Martin?
When I was in my previous community, I went to a weekday mass that was celebrated by a priest that was filling in for a priest that was usually at the parish, of course, Jesuit. And during his homily, it was during the Easter season, and so we're reading from the Acts of the Apostles. So, of course, what is this homily on? The fact that in the second half of the Acts of the Apostles, it centers exclusively on the missionary acts of St. Paul. And so his homily tended to focus on the question of if this is indeed the inspired word of Almighty God, why did the book of the Acts of the Apostles go from, well, the Acts of the Apostles to just strictly Paul's missionary endeavors? And his conclusion was the fact that because it ends in exclusively Paul's missionary endeavors, that this wasn't exactly the inspired word of God. That was it. That was his homily. There was at least one book in Scripture that wasn't the inspired word of God. And then he went on and continued Mass. And that was it. And this priest continues to function. And there I was sitting in my previous community. And then I went through everything that I went through. And then because I like the traditional Latin Mass, I got kicked out. That priest is still functioning who questions Scripture being the divinely inspired word of God. And here I am getting letters from my own bishop of the diocese I grew up in saying that I can't even have a a prayer room in my own house. You know, it's absolutely absurd. The degree that the church has stooped to is absolutely absurd. That the people that are in authority have zero credibility when they're attacking things like sacred scripture, the ecumenical councils of the past, besides Vatican II, of course, because they'll never attack that, the sacred cow. But that's just it. There was a bishop who at a USCCB meeting, in regards to Cardinal McCarrick, said, you know, he puts into question apostolic credibility. To be honest, I think that's been in question since Vatican II, apostolic credibility, because if you're going to deny such things as the fact that scripture is divinely inspired, you're putting into question everything that the apostles and their successors have ever put forth for us to believe.
Yeah, but do you see, like, the magnitude, Ryan taking his hit real quick off camera? Do you see the magnitude, though, of the lengths in the depths that these unholy prelates are willing to go, Ryan, to justify sodomy? They will kick Holy Scripture to the curb to justify sodomy. I mean, what further proof do we need that these people are all apostates?
Well, it's really they've kicked Scripture to the curb since the 40s or 50s, whenever it was Pius XII said, oh, well, you can have the tools of higher criticism, namely all the things that liberal Protestants came up with that emptied their pews and caused liberal Protestants to deny the sufficiency of Scripture to teach the truth in itself, right? That on their reckoning of it all, right? Yeah. So, and then we adopted all those tools, or I should say that the academics adopted all those tools. It became standard in the seminaries after Vatican II. Absolutely. It was like all you learned without Scripture is not true, basically. You look at, I might have the name wrong, R.C. Gabler, I think it was. He was a liberal Protestant, and he joined the Catholic Biblical Association. So his Protestant friend said, the Catholic Biblical Association? What are you doing that for? And he said, it's the only place a liberal Protestant feels at home these days. And because that it's become this kind of monolithic thing, the denial of creation, starting at that one, in favor of evolution, even though there's, you know, you're working on, there's no proof for it when you get down to it, actual scientific proof of it. So you have that. You've got so many different things where they've denied Scripture because it was convenient on this or that, or they misuse and abuse the Scripture on this or that. I mean, even right there, the cardinal in question, what's he doing? He's saying, well, it also says to stone at adulterers, and it says to do this women. So you have male and female, he created them. You have relating the history in Genesis of what God did to Sodom and Gomorrah on account of their sins. But even if you did want to play this stupid game, it didn't mean, you know, sodomy, it didn't mean homosexuality in Sodom and Gomorrah, fine, have that. Let's go to Paul in Romans 1:25, yep, where Paul is laying down what exactly this sin is and why people did it. So you got that. You have to deny that. But he's misusing even the Old Testament. He's pulling from the Jewish law, which was very clearly laid out to govern a specific people at a certain period of time. That's what the law was. And when the full revelation came from Christ, and now you have a universal people, you no longer need one law for one specific people. Now you have the full revelation of the moral law in Christ through the church. And that's how it's proliferated. And it was that hierarchy of that church. Paul himself, as he's establishing churches, he writes to the Catholics in Rome, and he tells them, why people turned to unnatural vices. Mm-hmm. And he lays it out there. This is not some obscure thing in the Jewish ceremonial law that properly interpreted doesn't affect us. This is a general moral principle of what's intrinsically evil that can't be done and why people turn to it. He gives the reason for it, for the whole mystery of iniquity right there.
Even Father Ribiger describes that, that particular vice is so unnatural and so disgusting that demons don't even witness it. They flee from it. It's so appalling to them. What we need, ladies and gentlemen, is to wash our eyes out a little bit. We need to hear from a good and holy bishop. And it actually kind of relates to the topic that we're talking about, insofar as wow, if Pius XII is writing bad encyclicals, if Pius XII is pushing the Big Bang, if Pius XII, then what are the set of Akantis, what are they going to say about all that? How far back do we have to go?
Archbishop Lefebvre, it's said, and I don't know if it's true today, you can confirm that or clarify it, that Your Excellency was very much on his side of endorsing the 1962 missile. It seems looking back, this was more of a fight between the recognize and resist philosophy and the Sedificantis point of view. Number one, do you think that all of that is true? And what do you think His Excellency would have done today, looking back with the resurgence of a return to the pre 1955 form?
Oh my, you that was not one question, it's a kind of packet of questions. But firstly, the question of liturgy doesn't have anything to do directly with Sedevacantism. It's what is true is that many of those who believe that the see is vacant, Sedevacantists, taking a strong line on the papacy, such as these popes are not genuine popes, also take a strong line on the liturgy. In other words, to go back to 1962 is not enough. You need to go back before 1955. But there's no direct connection between Sedevacantism and the question of the liturgy. It happens that many taking an extreme line in the one also take an extreme line in the other. That's part of an answer to your composite question. What else was there in the question? I've forgotten already.
Yes, well, the first part was, is it true that you were a strong supporter at the time of the 62? And then do you retain that position today?
That's fair enough as a question. The reason why Archbishop Lefebvre settled on 1962 is that there were reforms in 62, 64, 67, and finally 69. The Archbishop himself went along with the reforms on the grounds that the Pope is the master of the liturgy in the Latin rite of the Universal Church. In other words, it depends upon the Pope. And the Pope apparently wanted all of those reforms, 62, 64, 67, 69, when the Archbishop himself prayed the liturgy of 67, he realized that his faith was being diminished. Mm. He realized that the omitting all of these signs of the cross in the Mass, for instance, which is just one little instance, and praying the various changes that were already pretty far gone in 67, he said that he himself came back to 64. He founded the seminary in 70. The seminary of Econe began in 1970, and he began it on his personal experience with 64. The seminarians, a few years later, a few years into the 70s, the seminarians made it clear. One of them hid some of these lecterns. I remember his name. I won't dare quote it. But he came from a long way away from Europe. Let's just say that. He hid one of the lecterns on which the 64 lessons used to be read. He hid one of them. Now, the Archbishop didn't usually give way to rebels. He was not a rebel himself. Believe it or not, he was not a rebel, not by any stretch of the imagination. He was obedient absolutely to what he thought was the will of God through coming through the church. But coming through the church in the 60s was not all what coming from God. Therefore, he himself settled on 64, and the seminarians made him understand, gave him to understand, that they thought 64 was too far. And he must have thought, well, this is the Holy Ghost speaking through my ragamuffin seminarians. So he came back to 62, and that's where he settled. But his principle was, if 62 is not essentially against the faith, or is not diminishing the faith, then that's the latest that had the approval from Rome. Therefore, if I combine what I myself realize is against the faith. That's unacceptable. With what the Pope has approved, and that's at least at the latest 1962, then combining those two principles, 62 is where I settle. And he settled on 62. But notice that for the Holy Week, he himself never abandoned the knocking on the door of Palm Sunday, which I think was eliminated by Bonini in 55. So, and there was something else, I forget, the second confession, the Archbishop never eliminated the confession just before the communion. And so even he was not completely loyal to 62.
For those interested in that interview, it is on the main Restoring the Faith channel. You can check it out. It's almost 2 hours long. I can't believe His Excellency gave me that much time. Lots of ground covered. To put a finer point on, I did ask in the follow-up, are you okay with pre-55 priests? He said yes. There was a lot to unpack there, Ryan. I think it's probably worthy of going around and everyone just kind of reacting to whatever you'd like to react to, because he said a lot, either on the topic of SETI versus recognize and resist, or the liturgy itself, or the philosophy of Archbishop Lefebvre in sort of settling on the 72 for the reasons that he did.
Muted.
Whoops, I muted locally. It's always something of an inconsistency I've noticed with Lefebvre and how the society continues to celebrate, for example, Holy Week, where they will incorporate certain pre-55 elements, such as you still have the knocking at the door by the subdeacon with the foot of the cross, or again, the blessing of the palms is done facing ad orientem still, and not as the so-called restaurata. I mean, that's about as accurate as, never mind. I'm going to get in trouble, but the post 55 reforms, they direct you to say to do the blessing of the palms facing the people. And again, they also direct you to say that the priest to say the Our Father facing the people. That's how the rubrics direct it. And I don't know anyone that celebrates 62 that does it that way. Maybe, except maybe some diocesan places are just looking through a book and, oh, okay. And maybe they learn better. Who knows? But that's so that it's a bit of an inconsistency. But I think it also shows, too, that, maybe whether that's good or bad depends on your perspective. But Lefebvre was not already some crazy firebrand, reactionary. It's just going to do. He didn't even want to get started with the whole thing. They had to knock on his door and tell him, you have to lead us. Because he wasn't willing to go out and do anything himself. He was just going to retire in an apartment and call it good. Everything's going to heck. And he doesn't, because the seminary gets to see him all right, knocks on his door and says, you've got to get out here and lead us. So, but, when he made his approach, it was, all right, well, I'll do 64. Because it didn't seem that it was that far gone to him, until later. And I think that that should be interesting, especially for, the left, he's this terrible reactionary, or on the right, that think he was always that way. It doesn't really matter where you come at it. It's an interesting fact, I think, that he evolved as time went along.
Yeah, I found that actually to be very interesting, James, especially, the idea that Archbishop Lefebvre was such a prayerful man, and he was always seeking to see if Almighty God was speaking to him, even through his lowly seminarians, he measured by their fruits, you shall know them. In praying the 67 for some time, it did seem like his faith was diminishing. He had to go backwards, wasn't sure how far to go back, did settle on the 62. Now, a lot of SSPXers, James, at least in my subjective experience, are pretty dogmatic about the 62. They say Archbishop Lefebvre liked the 62, and therefore it's the 62 it will be, and there's no questions asked about it. Bishop Williamson kind of casts a little bit of doubt on that.
Well, you're absolutely right. If anyone knows Archbishop Lefebvre and his understanding of what he thought his role was, is basically not one of reactionism. He's not a reactionary. And so, of course, it took people to find him in retirement to give him more of the impetus he needed to go out and do what he needed to do. We know that he has seminarians who were hiding the lectionary from him, because they wanted him to say a different mass or readings at mass, rather, to use a different set of readings. And he, after a while, you know, he thought about it. And so, you know, a reactionary is not one who just says, this is it, and this is what it's going to be because this is the way I'm doing it. It's actually one who contemplates and who takes in all these questions into deep prayer. And, you know, a lot of us are coming to this understanding. You know, we've reflected on what the 1962 has done for us as a culture, you know, as traditionalists within this culture, within the modern world that we're living in. We definitely need to go back even further, you know, and some of us are now arriving in that 54 conclusion, pre-55 conclusion, you know, and I couldn't agree with Bishop Moore. You know, I don't think Archbishop Lefebvre would have held fast to 62 if he had lived to this day. You know, he would have had to reconsider some of his positions, you know, and, you know, there's a lot to unpack there. There's a lot more you're probably thinking about after what I just said.
Yeah, no, I mean, and there's more to say as well, Brother Martin, because, you know, maybe my framing of the question to His Excellency was a little bit unfair, but it does seem like the historical retelling of the lore, let's say the legend, is that the supposedly the reason that the Sanborns and split and became Sede Vacantis was over the pre-55 versus the 62. That's what a lot of people claim. That's even, I think, what Bishop Sanborn claims. But there's more to the story, it seems. I don't think it was as cut as dry and dry as that, at least according to Bishop Williamson, who would have been a contemporary of these discussions.
And I don't think Sanborn's group would ever let it just remain as that, precisely because even after the split, they continue to develop more and more opinions that are separate from the SSPX. That are unique to them, that ultimately there becomes a lot of differences between the SSPX and Sanborn's group, so that we can't just say, even though the split may have been just because of the pre-55 missile, you can't, the differences between the two is more than just the pre-55 missile. However, I agree with what Williamson said on your interview, precisely saying, you know, this shouldn't be the straw that breaks the camel's back, so to speak. It shouldn't be the be-all, end-all of what traditionalism means, which missile you choose. But nonetheless, there are very good reasons to choose the pre-55 missile. And Bishop Williamson says these reasons are particularly, prayerful regarding prayer and what the liturgy teaches us about our faith. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what liturgy is supposed to do. I mean, from our very birth, the first prayers we learn are from our mothers, and the very first prayers we learn teach us what we believe. And that's exactly what the liturgy is supposed to do, is to teach us what we believe. Lex orandi, lex credendi, the law of prayer is the law of belief. And so if a certain form of the Mass helps you understand what it is to be a Catholic, what to believe to be a Catholic, well, that form, well, it's good, it's Catholic. And if there's a form that simply does not do any of that, doesn't teach you anything about what it means to be a Catholic, like the Novus Ordo, at least for me, from my experience of growing up as a Novus Ordo Catholic, you know, it should give us great pause. So I think Bishop Williamson is correct in saying, you know, and I think personally he accepts the 62 and he does the 62, but he's open to those who appreciate the pre-55. I think he's good to accept. To be kind of broad in this acceptance, as opposed to the Sede Vacantis to say, no, just this or just this, you know, just the pre-55 or just the 55, like the CMRIs, or just the 62, like the SSPX. I think as traditionalists, we need to be a little bit more broad, precisely because, these rites are traditional in the sense that they're not Novus Ordo. The Novus Ordo is explicitly a new theology. So that we can talk and discuss precisely what helps us to pray better. And I think ultimately, my personal opinion is that the pre-55 liturgy will ultimately triumph as that which teaches us better what is Catholic theology. Mm-hmm.
I find it to be one of the great ironies of our time that it's the Ecclesia Dei communities who have largely gone pre-55, especially during Holy Week, Ryan. But some of them, especially in the smaller, like outlying parishes, are getting away with it year round. I think it'd be a good tactical thing for the SSPX to do, to just go ahead and return to the pre-55, because I think that would blunt the main argument that the SETI contests now are now making, retrospectively looking back and saying, look how right we are. You know, all of you are getting on the pre-55 thing, and this is why we split from Monsignor Lefebvre. That's not why they split over at Monsignor Lefebvre, in my estimation, or in Bishop Williams's estimation. So I think, you know, just mute that argument, make it a moot point by everyone just getting on the pre-55 bandwagon. What do you think?
It works for me, because I frankly, the principle we should be applying here is we're going back before Bonini was in a position to touch anything.
That's right.
That's really what the principle is that everything that his entire approach and those he studied under, because I mean, obviously Bonini was just cutting his teeth in the years leading up to the 55 reform, and the older modernists were already there working on that. You know, his contributions are less than they would be, say, to, you know, when he's running the Concilium, then he's in the place to carry out what was done in 55. But irrespective of that, that whole mindset that came out of the World War II generation toward liturgy, that has to be, you know, completely cut out and uprooted from the liturgical life of the church. And really the best way to do that is go back. You just look at so many elements of the pre-55, which it's not even just the Holy Week. Granted, they're minor. And we're not saying you're not as trad if you go to a 62 Mass. We're not saying stay home and don't go to Mass if your Mass is 62. We're not saying these things so right. That people don't get the wrong idea. We're not saying that we're better than you because we go to a 55 Mass. No, we're saying that the pre-55 is better, and this is why we should aspire to it. And you look at, for example, it doesn't even add that much time to the Mass, but it's like, oh, we got to trim some time off it. The collects, so you have the collect or the oratio that takes place after the Gloria. There were additional ones that would be said, and sometimes they're directed to be specific ones, say during Advent and during Lent, and you know, against pray, you know, to deliver the church from persecution, to for Our Lady's protection of the church, for the Pope. Very specifically. And then further, it would continue also at the secret prayer, which concludes the offertory, and also the post-communion. There would be additional prayers that you would say, much as like at a weekday Mass, you would get a commemoration, because in 62 they dropped commemorations on Sundays. So, you know, that's just like one of many different elements that just add to the beauty of it, add to, you know, the whole idea that we should be praying for the situation of the church in the world. And we're going to do it three times at very specific times, prayers written in that context, you know, in terms of like the secret prayer, which is, you know, not because it's secret, but secretum, right? You know, it's because it's said in a low voice, and I forget. There's an explanation you can find in Gear and Garinger and people like that, if you want to, that'll lay it out more clearly. I can't remember the proper explanation for the secretum at that point, but it doesn't matter. It's said, and it concludes the offertory. It's tailored for that very specifically. And then you look at the octaves. You know, you need to be able to, you know, you come on to a feast through fasting, right? And if you're some type of penance, you know, the vigil of a feast, you would always wear violet, and then you'd have the feast day, and then you come off the feast, right? And you have the octave, mm-hmm. and then that octave would continue. You had it, so many of them during the year, and they weren't terribly oppressive. And you had obviously for Our Lady, and you also had for the Ascension, for Transfiguration. You have them for, you know, so many different feasts during the year. And they're completely stripped away in 62, except for the Christmas octave and the Easter octave, I believe. And there might be one more that I'm not thinking properly, that we're allowed to survive Bonini's kind of hatcheting. And the Eastern rites of the church, their liturgies, they have that focus on the preparation. And then what they call, you know, they have the octave. And then they have the leave-taking, a special feast that concludes the octave of that particular feast. And they've got multiple of those as well. And that's hasn't hurt their liturgy any, hasn't made it so oppressively burdensome that they can't say their liturgies. So why is it so oppressive and burdensome in the Roman liturgy? Because some guy felt that way and cut it out.
I'm so glad that you mentioned that. Look, if I were stranded on a desert island for the rest of my life and all I had was a 62, I'd be thanking God. I'd be so happy to have the 62. So you're right.
Upset.
This isn't like snobbery. Like, this is, you know what I mean?
Right? Because we got to talk about what we aspire to, but sometimes when you do, people get the wrong idea and they think that you're judging them somehow or you're.
People personalize.
Aren't you satisfied? We just got our mass here.
Look, I'm the flow of LaSance missile on my shirt. I'm making sure if I'm ever stranded on an island, I at least have
that's
that.
That's it. But, you know, look, if you have to choose between the 62 and this.
I'll open the four directions. I will whistle four times. This is a wild turkey bone I've had for about 20 years, and I use it in my ceremonies. Before I do that, I'd like for you to put your hands on your heart, each one of you. The heart can be like a talking stick, but that's where the Creator put wisdom in humans. And we often need to remind ourselves of this. It's an important gesture to connect ourselves with that wisdom. I asked the Western grandmother to give us access to the sacred circle of spirits so they can be with us, so we can be united and stronger together.
Okay, all right. That's all I can do. That's all I can do. I think Brother Martin literally just smashed his computer. Like I said, I'll take the 62 over that any day, right? I mean,
right?
At that point, it's like not snobbery. It's just take what you can get.
Mm-hmm.
Guys, it's really flown by, but it's time.
Okay, so I wasn't quite ready for that, so let me pull something up here.
I gave you no notice, zero notice.
Right, zero notice. So we finished moving, thanks be to God. That's done with the miserable process. Once everything gets set up, I'm not moving. I'm just not going to do it. So anyway, it's so we're kind of settled in. I'm slowly getting back to work, hopefully. But let me see here. I've got to figure out. There we go. So I've got some new books that should be coming out relatively soon. No. I think I want to do it this way. Okay. Yeah, there we go. So it just hasn't. Oh, yeah, I don't have the back text yet. Anyway, so one moment. Let me switch over my screen. So there is a great book, Her Feast Day. This particular Blessed, actually, recently canonized, will be on September 14th. So Blessed Mary Celeste Costa Rosa. And I thought about doing Maria, but it's generally given as Mary in the book, so I just kept that in the title. So who is she? Have you ever heard of this person before? Probably not. That's why Mediatrix Express is here, to help you, again, to find people in the tradition that you may have never heard of. So she is the founder of the Redemptorist Teens, that is the Redemptorist Nuns. And actually, her rule was extremely inspiring to St. Alphonsus Liguori. And Alphonsus Liguori, when he encountered her, came her director, helped her to get this institute going, and that's how he got the Redemptorist started. All right, and so without her, you probably don't have a St. Alphonsus, at least not as the founder of the Redemptorist. Mm-hmm. So this is a great book, and like a lot of really well-written biographies, it is not just pure, you know, not just, it's not a dry, boring history. It's not some crazy hagiographical saints, you know, biography. They're going on about various miracles and you're sitting there like, what's the basis for this? You know, is there, you know, this is a really well-written biography. It's a spiritual biography. So it covers not just the events in her life and how she, you know, got the order, you know, started and all her life work, but also her interior life, her spiritual life, etc. So this one will be out by September, probably a lot earlier than that. We'll see. And so then there's one more coming out. Someone actually used to publish this, and I just got to find it. Hold on. Here we go. Anyway, used to publish this book. It's a little devotional of St. Alphonsus, and here we go. Anyway, so he offered it to me, and so we worked out the rights, and it's not a major harrowing work. So anyway, let me get this over. But it's a wonderful little book for ta-da, there we go. So St. Alphonsus Liguori for every day. So it's about 100 pages or so. It's basically like a thoughts of book. Like, you know, you get little books, thoughts of St. Therese, things you take with you to, you know, you have in your stand for morning prayers, or you take with you to adoration or what have you. But it's divided up with, you know, really well organized, tightly, you know, organized thoughts of St. Alphonsus for every single day of the entire year. And it's a small book. You know, it's only 100 so pages, or just over that. So the anyway, so it's on pre-order right now. So I got to approve the final cover and then hopefully get copies of it next week. So if you buy it, I shall have it by then. And again, nice, handy little book, especially if you want to combine it with something else, which I might recommend, like this one, which I've talked about before, The Ascent of the Mind of God by the Ladder of Creation. Awesome treatise by St. Robert Bellarmine on the heavens, on, you know, all these things that God created to help us get to heaven itself, on man, on angels, on even God's nature, and how every last thing that God put in the world in creation is designed to get us to heaven. And so anyway, so that's what I have, plus many more books at Mediatrix Press. I do have, you know, a ton of needs still that I'm trying to, you know, get, because we're looking at getting our property fence. That's a big bill, so that's going to have to wait. We're still waiting for the house to get put up, but all that paperwork got, you know, finished off and taken care of. So that should finally be happening soon. So if you, so in your heart, what is it Mother Angelica said? Put us between the gas and the electric bill. You know, something else. Basically, yeah. So think of a book. You know, and I prefer, you know, look and see some books you like. Please buy them. I just updated the inventory, so we shouldn't be showing back orders and things I actually have. And one more thing to make extra long my grift. I just got to find it and open it. But next week, actually, we got to figure out what exactly we're doing for the rundown next week.
Ooh. Because
at this very time, I will be at Mater Dei Parish in Dallas, and I will be talking, get the thing up here. Where did you go? There we go. I will be talking about Saints John Fisher and Thomas More at Mater Dei Catholic Church in Irving, Texas, in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. So if you're reasonably close to that, you know, please do come. I know some people that are making a drive a couple hours to come, which, I mean, really? hope you're going to get a lot of alcohol, because, man, you're going to need it. But no, really, it's going to be an excellent conference. And so, and I'm not just going to blab. I'm going to blab with a PowerPoint, show you all kinds of original documents and manuscripts and things that connect history that you didn't know. So Friday night, next Friday night, I'm going to start my blabbing at 7, purely on St. John Fisher. So if you want to know more about St. John Fisher, and you didn't want to buy my book because you're not going to read 300 pages about him, this is a great chance to see how he connects with so much in the learning of the time. What an absolutely brilliant figure he was. His theological writings against Luther, where I'll take time to explore actually a bit of his theology on a lot of different things you never knew about, because you didn't know he wrote all these things because they're in Latin. Saturday morning, we'll kind of pause with Fisher's life as we get to what's covered in the third talk, as we get to the Catherine of Aragon situation. So then Saturday morning, there's mass and, you know, a little light breakfast will be provided. Friday night, there's going to be some refreshments. Then I'm going to get going on Thomas More and Henry VIII. And what I've done with this one, instead of just giving you a straight up biography of More than straight of Henry, I've intertwined them into the actual chronology of how everything progresses from More's birth through Henry's accession to the throne, and all the way, just as we stop with Fisher, again, right before the situation that begins with the king's great matter, because then that's the last talk where I get to abuse you for an hour and 15 minutes of intense discussion of politics, theology, the whole question of the annulment. We've got lots of manuscripts, lots of things that you don't really pick out except in complicated academic works. And the, you know, to help give a little more detail to all the things that went on. So it's going to be a great time. There's going to be a lot to learn, a lot for me to get through. So I will also be there with books. And so, and if there's a specific book that you want and you don't want to pay shipping on and you're going to be there, let me know so that hopefully I can get it if I don't have it, but I should have it. And I'll make sure to bring a couple copies so that I'll have one for you. And where my daughter will be checking everybody out at the checkout for the my point of sale thing, so I can grift more books.
As you all know, I'm Brother Martin, and I'm a founder of a new traditional Augustinian monastery. Recently, started back last November, we received a particular attack from a particular media organization.
Fake news.
That question, exactly, fake news organization, that question our tax-exempt status. And they particularly asked, like, having been existed in less than 1 year, why they haven't filed for the 1093 form or whatever it's called for tax exemption. And there were several reasons for that. One is that being a religious organization, we didn't necessarily need it because we're automatically tax-deductible. And tax deduction and tax exempt are two different reasons. But also because we had something like over 2+ years ability to file that form. And it precisely says that at the top of the form needed to file for tax exemption with the IRS. So if I can share my screen, let's see. Do I have this possibility? Oh, man, what is it?
I don't know if you have that power.
Please. Okay, well,
can I give you power?
Maybe not. Do I?
Do I have that? Is power? It a web address? If it's a web address, share it to me in the private chat, and I'll put it up for you.
It's not. No, that's the.
You're sharing your screen, brother.
How do I go out of this?
Okay, there you go. Okay. Are you sharing when you share screen?
Okay, what I need to do?
It should. It says show entire screen. Then there's window. Then there's whatever browser you got open. I think Chrome. It's optimized for Chrome. So if you're using Chrome, it'll say Chrome tab. It may have it for Firefox. I'm not sure.
Okay. All right, listen, if you want our determination letter, you can have our determination letter. I have it. We have our determination letter to say we're both tax deductible and tax exempt because we filed between the IRS's time limit or whatever that they require, and we got it. But there's still an article out on the web saying that we're not tax deductible and tax exempt. As of a few weeks ago, it's completely and totally false. But this news organization isn't committed enough to the truth to update their article.
Fake news.
So I wanted to say that for those that are committed to the truth, here's the truth, that we're tax deductible and tax exempt. So if you want to support a traditional Augustinian monastery in the future of traditional Catholicism, you can go to www.openstandaugustine.com/giving. And we have our determination letter as opposed to contrary to what this fake news article says about us.
All right. Third time's a charm. Hey, it's time to grip.
Hello, Leo. This is a great book. I haven't had the chance to grift this book for you guys out there. This is a monumental work by Bishop Tissier de Malaret. This book basically is the wonderful biography of Marcel Lefebvre. I almost said Saint Marcel Lefebvre. In any case, this is very well documented, well sourced. It's a great book. It gives you a lot of insights into the Archbishop's life, into his upbringing, what makes him or what made him who he was, and why he, the man of his age in that time, in the early 20th century, was sent to mission to those in Africa, and how that helped him in his mission post-Vatican II in order to build a society which he used to sustain and to maintain the faith of Catholics in the world now. Obviously, started small at Cone and broadened out to the rest of the world. Great stories here. It talks about a lot of his relationships within the Vatican, especially with Cardinal Ratzinger at the time, who later became Pope Benedict. If you want to know why I'm so critical of Ratzinger, a lot of that you can find in this book. And a lot of what's in this book actually helped me understand how the machine of the Vatican works. And it hasn't changed. You know, so earlier, before I really understood what the Vatican was doing, and certain questions in my mind, I couldn't quite wrap around until I read this book. And then I understood, oh, wow, there is a deep state. And the deep state, much as we see in the political realm, also exists in the ecclesial realm. So this is a great book. Thanks to Mrs. C for linking this book here. I think everyone should go read it. You don't have to be a fan of the Archbishop to want to know exactly what his mission was. And honestly, I know a person whom you all know who did not really understand who the Archbishop was and was not a fan of his until he read the book, until he read this book. And then he understood exactly what was going on, you know? So this book is a great resource and everyone should pick this up. And yeah, you know, when you do, just shoot me a Twitter message and let me know how you're enjoying it.
I'd like to grift today for my namesake, Saint Michael, Saint Michael the Archangel. Saint Michael's Lent is coming up. It begins very soon. It starts after the feast of the Assumption, the 15th of August. I want to grift two things with respect to Saint Michael's Lent and tell you a little bit about it. First of all, I want to grift this book here. It's called Consecration to Saint Michael. It's a little 9-day preparation. It's put out by Angelus Press. Happened to be at the Angelus Press bookstore earlier today. Ran into some old friends. Consecration to St. Michael, written by a man who I have met in person, Cajal, and I admire him. St. Michael's Lent was popular in the Middle Ages. It was a mini Lenten period from August 15th until September 29th, which is the feast of St. Michael the Archangel. So today, if you're listening to this live or if you're watching it within a couple days, we're coming up on August 15th. That's when the St. Michael's Lent begins. Get your copy from Angelus Press, Consecration to St. Michael. And you'll have plenty of time for it to arrive so that 9 days out from the 29th of September, you can make your consecration. Second thing I want to grift, also related to St. Michael, the Feast of St. Michael. If you go to Our Warpath, we had Joe Riggi come on a couple weeks ago on the rundown, talk about the Rosary March that he wants to lead on September 29th and September 30th, the Feast of St. Michael, and the day after in Peoria, Illinois. That rosary walk, just walking into the parish there, walking into the cathedral, has been suppressed by the local bishop there, which is, of course, as always, backfiring against these modernist bishops. More people are joining. Our buddy Matt Gaspers with Catholic Family News has just been added as one of the speakers at this thing. So they're going to have speakers, Archbishop Vigano, Father Altman, John Henry Weston, Doug Berry. He's going to do some push-ups for you. And then Matt Gaspers. So this is a little spontaneous thing that is catching fire
I think even Taylor Marshall has endorsed it. The March for Catholics happening in Illinois. It's a 2 or 3 mile walk. It ends in the church there in Peoria. And then there's some booths and some talks. I think it's a good thing. It's a good thing to do. It happens on the Feast of St. Michael. Again, get the book. And it's good practice for some of the longer walks that happen in the fall, notably the Three Hearts Pilgrimage, which I still plan to be at in October in Oklahoma. Finally, don't forget, I would still love to stick it to those fake newsers, so you can donate to my legal defense at, what is my website? GiveSendGo.com/DefeatCMTV. All right, guys, we have to do more important things than grift. We have to give our unpopular opinions tonight, and we start, as always, with our good buddy, Ryan Grant. And you're muted a second time! I win! I haven't done it once tonight! Yes, I win! I win! I win!
Settle down there, Marine.
Yeah, right? All right, let's see. Yeah, of course, I started talking as I was looking for this. There we go. So, okay. I got the desk elevated, so it's shaking a little bit more.
Wait, first of all, who won the last one?
I never put the last one up because I didn't have internet access, and my wife was sick, and I didn't manage the house.
We slacked last week, so we're off. I know.
Ryan was moving, and I'm starting a new thing, and people are just doing stuff.
So this week's will go up, though. I'll do it tonight. But anyway, so where are we? Unpops. In the wake of Tradiciones Custodes, jailers of the tradition, as I affectionately translate it, there's been a lot. I've noticed it in a lot of places on Twitter and some other ones in the, how should we put it? For those who do not favor Ecclesia Dei communities, diocesan TLMs, whatever, say that, well, they've compromised. They're not trad enough for us, which, hey, go where you're going to go. I don't care. And as you know, I'm not anti anything as far as, you know, I go to an FSSP church. I have nothing against the SSPX. Or anyone who goes there. I've even turned around my views. At least I've softened on it towards Sedevacantists. And whereas if you remember older stuff I've done, I used to be much harder on them. I still don't agree with it, but at least personally, you know, I have less interest in attacking them. Now we really need trad unity. And so I've seen in a lot of places people saying, oh, look, well, just as well as if France is suppressing all these masses, it's great. Well, people are losing their liturgical home, right? People are losing something that's been spiritually valuable to them, and they may be in an area where they don't have the SSPX or anyone else. We shouldn't be rejoicing over the actual, even if you think it's good, and there's a certain level where even I think it's like, well, let's finally get the battle lines drawn. But at the same time, you know, we shouldn't be rejoicing over people losing their spiritual homes, which I have seen some people doing. And so my unpopular opinion is we need more trad unity. Stop the circular firing squad. Stop, you know, and I've seen a lot of posts crop up. The Benedictines do a lot of this, but the Sedevacantists, there's certain Sedevacantists that are doing this too. Well, you can tell Bergoglio is not a real pope because a real pope wouldn't do this. That's a logical fallacy. That's the no true Scotsman fallacy. You know, obviously he's not a true Scotsman because a true Scotsman does it this way. It's so and so on and so forth, right? Stick to your arguments for your position that are actually, you know, based on principles and logic and reason. Don't go to these things, and let's support each other because we all want the tradition. You know, if you're going to diocesan traditional mass, for the most part, you want the tradition. Or your fraternity, you go to fraternity masses, you want the tradition. If you're going to the society, you want the tradition. If you're going to independent chapels, you want the tradition. If you're going to a set of Sedevacantist churches, because you want the tradition and you think this is the best way to recoup it. All right, we can all come to certain levels. All right, we don't agree on the how or the mechanics per se. There's certain issues on one side or the other that will have to be reconciled at some point for sure. But let's kind of end the hate fest in social media against each other and against all these people. Let's work on recouping the tradition and praying for the tradition and bring about a unity amongst traditional Catholics rather than the circular firing squad and the and especially if you're out there and you're not praying and there are people like this, but you're tweeting all day about whatever issue and going after modernists and whatever. We're going to own FSSP, or on the flip side, we're going to own the SSPX, or we're going to own those SETIs, or the SETIs. We're going to own those recognize and resist people, whatever. Stop it. Let's focus on we know what we want. We know what we love. Let's bring together, you know, at least united in charity, recognizing that everyone here wants the tradition, even if we don't agree how we're going to get there. And that's my unpopular opinion.
All right. That's a good one. Brother Martin.
I don't know how the Sanborn said is going to take that. But my unpopular opinion is this time it's not going to be toilet paper. And even though baby formula also is very much a necessity for the survival of infants, or it can be in certain circumstances, before the November elections, I really do believe there's going to be some sort of crisis for all of us, that the government is going to take some sort of object that we need to sustain our life, whether it be extremely high prices for meat that we can't even afford it, whether it be gasoline, whether it be even the price of purified water or something. There's going to be some sort of crisis that we're all going to have to face collectively, even if it's just 1 week or 2 weeks before the midterm elections, because they want to sell to us that we need them and we need to cling to them, all that kind of stuff. And so that's kind of my popular opinion, is that the New World Order, the WEF, or the Biden administration, whatever, they're going to continue to antagonize us. They're going to continue to try to put pressure on us and try to sell us the fact that we need them, that they're the daddy government, their papa government, we can't trust ourselves to sustain our own lives, to provide for ourselves, and that we ultimately depend on the government, which is obviously untrue. So that's my popular opinion, is that daddy government is going to come down on us again.
Yeah, okay, we got some softballs this week. Unite the clans and distrust the government. James, come on, this is your chance to win. But you do have to unmute to win. You still have to unmute to win.
I'm kidding. Okay, here we go.
Oh, you had me.
Okay. All right. Here's my unpopular opinion this week. So this week we've heard Bishop Williamson give us various accounts of his story and the mind of certain people around him at the time, and we've heard a lot of history. So I've come to the conclusion, I may have felt this for a while, but now it makes sense to sort of say it out loud and say it proud. I think Bishop Williamson is a traditionalist hero. And the reason I say this is because he stood his ground early on against the mob and the media and within the ranks of the church, the modernists, the conservatives, and even other traditionals basically united in clanship to cancel Bishop Williamson. So this is another uniting of the clans back before it was popular, right? This was the first, a lot of these people united. You had the liberal progressive media, you had the conservative media, you had the modernists and the traditionalists in the church. Everybody conspired to basically silence Williamson and push him out. And even his own society confreres decided they had had enough. And he was actually asked to compromise on a couple of things. And he stood his ground and he did not acquiesce to those demands. And he knew what it meant. He knew he would be canceled. And what did he do? He didn't take the pen and sign. He didn't read a statement. He didn't offer any apologies. He just quickly sort of went away, and that's kind of what we see today is a need. We need people like that, who can say something and then back it up by their action. And so we hear, or we're reminded of Benedict's speech, pray for me that I may not flee for fear of the wolves. And then as soon as he said that, he turned around and basically ran the opposite direction from the wolves, And so we have to think about this. I mean, I don't believe 100% of Bishop Williamson's views. Well, maybe 95%, you know, but certainly not 100% of his views. I just realized that in this time, especially when it calls, when we're in a time as today that calls for people to stand and have moral courage, it takes someone like Williamson standing with what he thinks is true and what is real, objectively speaking, and not being crucified for it, or rather to stand tall and then being crucified for it and not having to back down. And you know, that in my view is something that's lacking in today's world. You know, we can't even have Cardinal Burke speak very openly about, you know, Pope Francis, and that's very scary. So he issued some words of comfort to traditionalists this past week, but it was neither here nor there, really. Firing a blank weapon. You know, someone such as Bishop Williamson is the person who honestly was canceled first and is more relevant today after his cancellation than any other time within his episcopate. And so I think he's a traditionalist hero, and a lot of people don't like this. It's not a popular idea to even bring up his name in polite traditionalist circles. Mm-hmm. But there we go. I've said that.
Okay, this is the week I'm going to win.
Wait, should we get a quick summary of James' unpop?
What's that? What was that?
Because I'm trying to write these down for the poll. James, can you summarize your unpop again?
Yeah, Bishop Williamson is a traditionalist hero.
I love it. Okay, it's no question that we have a crisis in masculinity in the world today, and unfortunately that we're not immune to that crisis also within the traditionalist circles. I think the reasons for it are a little bit different, though. And in fact, I'm the person who tells you every week, I tell you every week, homeschool is public school is a mortal sin. I say it because I think it's true. I've heard it from traditional priests, and I've reasoned my way to it. Are there exceptions? Yeah, of course there are exceptions. Homeschooling is one of the more reasonable options that we have right now for raising our sons. Many people don't have access to a good, legitimate, trustworthy, authentic Catholic school. But ladies and gentlemen, today what I'm going to tell you is another nuance to that. The fact of the matter is, homeschooling boys, there's a danger in homeschooling boys because at a certain point, a man cannot become a man until he detaches from his mother. And who is usually the primary schooler in a homeschool setup? It is the mother. Who is usually the controlling helicopter mom who's making sure that everyone's doing what they're supposed to do? It's the mother. And when it comes to boys and the mother detaching from her sons and letting him go, it's often, and even in traditional circles, the mother who refuses to do that. And it's a light form of feminism, but it's a very dangerous form of feminism. And it stunts the growth of young men. Until and unless a young man can leave his home and become self-reliant, and ideally go through some kind of physical endurance where he has to trust his own physical capabilities and see himself as becoming one of the men, as belonging to men, having a crucible, let's say. Until and unless he can do that, he will not become a man. And so my unpopular opinion is that I think a lot of traditional homeschooling mothers are stunting the growth of their young men and preventing them from becoming men, and they're keeping them as boys. And the fact of the matter is, a lot of you young ladies in tradition can't find a man. You look around at your parish, you can't find someone who is an adult, who is self-reliant, who can provide and protect. Because that's what a man does. He provides and protects. And you can't find that at your parish, and the reason why is because the homeschool kids have a detached from their mommies. So mothers who are watching this, you got to let go.
And you might have to let go a little bit sooner than you think. You're not letting go at 27, okay? If you're letting go at 27, there's a big problem. And that is my unpopular opinion. Trad moms are making effeminate little boys. That does it. How do I get this thing off here, Ryan?
You're all
there good. It is. It's off.
Here we go.
Can I make a
prediction?
What's that?
Can I make a prediction?
Oh, yeah. Predict it.
All right. So many of you may have seen this tweet from the bishop. Where is it? There it is. The Bishop of Rhode Island, Bishop Thomas Tobin. I'm convinced that if the church is to prosper in the present age, it can't hesitate to embrace and support traditional Catholics, traditional liturgies, and traditional moral values. And you've got Scott Hahn to retweet it, which is awesome, actually. But what's going to happen to poor Bishop Thomas Tobin? Well, apart from envisaging a red hat is not in his future, I think that was already obvious. I would not be surprised if a apostolic visitation at some point doesn't come down and it may cause him to have to step down.
Yeah.
My prediction is simply if there's any Latin Mass communities in his diocese, that they'll simply be removed and he'll...
That's mine as well. So at this point, he's got no control over it because he's shown himself not to be a very strong, courageous bishop in general. He wavers, and so with a little pressure, and he might not be the one actively doing it, but Rome might just come in anyway and just decide we're doing this for your sake.
And he'll be there as the coward.
Right,
exactly. So 75 is the coward.
Right.
Well, he might be able to get away with those comments given that, what happened to Father Jackson. So maybe he's immune. Maybe he's got a free pass.
Ah, I see. Always a conspirator.
Mm-hmm. Now he gets to play both sides. One. I know Ryan is the conspirator. Everything I learned about conspiracy theories, I learned from Ryan Grant.
The king of conspiracies, the anarchist.
People are asking us if we'll do 6 hours since we skipped last week. I don't think we can do 6 hours, but just to make sure, just to underwrite that I'm going to win the unpopular opinion, I'm going to give you Tucker Carlson's advice to young men as your outro. Good night, good evening, God bless you. Thank you for watching.
Advice to young people, particularly young men, is just dive face first into it. Like, drop out of college. College is ridiculous. Unless you're moving towards some very specialized degree that you can only get in college, if you want to be a veterinarian or a physicist or something. But if you're in humanities, I can give you a list of 100 books. You can find it on the internet and you'll be better educated than you would be at whatever stupid college you go to. A. B, get married and, choose wisely, but don't overthink it. Don't overthink it. People overthink it. Like, if you're compatible with someone and you can smell that, you can make it work. And by the way, it's never easy because men and women fundamentally don't understand each other. That's the whole joy in it. That's why marriage makes you grow, is because you don't really understand the other person. So you have to try every day to decipher what that person's saying. Have more children than you can afford. Take a job you're not qualified for. Like, go balls out. Just go balls out. I don't know what is ever.
I've always considered myself to be an inclusive educator, but it's only been in the past few years that I put my words into actions. So at the start of a semester, I ask my students for their pronouns, a reminder that they are not preferred, but they are the pronouns that we should be addressing them by. And I also ask them to tell me if I can use their pronouns in front of the class, in front of other teachers, and when I call home, because everyone is in a different part of their journey, and we need to be able to respect that.
And the question is whether or not we should be in a position where you are. Why can't the experts say we know that this virus is in fact it's going to be? We know why all the drugs approved are not temporarily approved but permanently approved.
Yeah.
You got the vaccination?
Yeah.
Are you okay? I mean, you seem, no, it works. Or you know, or the mom and dad, or the neighbor, or when you go to church, or when you're, I really mean it. There are trusted interlocutors. Think of the people, if your kid wanted to find out whether or not there's a man on the moon or whatever, you know, something, or, you know, whether those aliens are here or not. You know, who are the people they talk to beyond the kids who love talking about it?
Oh, look out. Wow, that is a tough kid right there.
So this is really cool because as a pitcher, Bubs looks shaken up right now because of what he did. And look at Zay Jarvis. This is such great sportsmanship. He wants him to know that it's okay, that he'll be fine.
Hey, Bub. Look at me. Look at me. You're all right.
Amazing.
You're all right. Look at me. Hey, look. You didn't go in public.